existence of God, all human beings have the capability of knowing and answering that question, but we cannot know everything about God. But the important conclusion to take away from this is just because we don't know everything about God doesn't mean that we can't know something about God. That's very important, right? Because, for example, when, you know, a century ago they were studying the atom, right, they didn't know about, for example, electrons and protons, all right? They just knew that they were atoms in general, okay? Or maybe 10, 20 years after that, they came to learn about electrons and protons, but they didn't really know about quarks and the different flavors and types of quarks that are there. Or later on, when they came to know about that, they didn't really know about, you know, substring theory or string theory, right? But just because they didn't know the details of the atom did not mean that those things which they said about the atom were wrong, or that they could not know something about the atom. They could. We say the same of God. We can know about God, but we don't claim to know everything about God. Okay? In fact, it's very interesting. One of the reasons for why God has created us, according to Islamic traditions, is so that we should know Him. Right? So I think one of the questions all of us often ask ourselves is, you know, why did God create us? Kids will ask you. You will have asked yourself, you know, people in general ask, probably the most important question out there, why did God create us? Now, I often point out to some of my students that, look, this is two questions loaded into one question, right? So the first question is, what did God want to benefit for Himself out of the act of creation? And then the second question is, well, whatever He wanted to benefit for Himself, that aside, what does He want us to do on this earth? What is our purpose and goal on the face of this earth? Unless you distinguish these two questions, you will get very confused when trying to answer them. So, for example, sometimes when people don't make this distinction, a child comes and asks them, you know, why did God create us? They remember that very important verse in the Quran which says, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. Well, God created us because He wanted us to worship Him. Then the child, the next question that he asks is, well, why does God need us to worship Him? And then the father has a difficulty answering that question. But if you realize there are two separate questions, the first one is, well, what benefit did God want from creation? On that first question, we're very clear that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, any time, let's not even talk about Allah right now, let's talk about any human being. We say a wise human being always has a purpose in whatever he does, right? This morning when you woke up, you came to university, there was a reason for it, right? What was the reason? You wanted to acquire knowledge. Or if you wake up and you go to work in the morning, there's a reason for it. And the reason for that is you want to acquire some money for yourself. There has to be some benefit in it for yourself as well. Well, did you ever think that any time you assume a benefit, you also have to assume a defect as well, right? The reason you came to study is because you didn't have that knowledge. If you had that knowledge, you wouldn't have come. The reason why you go to work to acquire money is because you don't have that money. If you had that money, you wouldn't bother to wake up in the morning, right? If you assume any personal benefit for God, at the same time you also have to assume a defect for God. And you cannot assume a defect for God. And therefore, God does not create because there is a personal benefit to Him. He creates because that is who He is. He is Al-Khaliq, the Creator. He doesn't need any external reasons for Him to engage in creation. He is Al-Jawad, He is the Generous. He doesn't need any other reason besides who He is to act in the to engage in the act of generosity, of giving existence to things, right? Like sugar, nobody asks why sugar is sweet. That is what sugar is, by definition, sweet. Why does God create? Doesn't have to be a reason for that. That is who God is. He is the Creator and the Generous One. But coming to the second question now, whatever that reason was, why did God create us? Meaning, what is our purpose and goal in life? Well, there you can say, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. Our purpose is to worship God. Now, on that note, we come to the hadith that's in front of you from the third imam, an Abi Abdullah, from the sixth imam, qala kharaj al-Husayn ibn Ali, Husayn, the son of Ali, the son of Abi Talib, ala ashabih, came out in the presence of his companions, فقال, then he said, أيها الناس, you don't have the Arabic, but you do have the English, so just follow me in the English. Page one, it's the font is centered. Yeah. Just before the definition of agnosticism, أيها الناس, O people, إن الله جل ذكره, surely God, may his remembrance be exalted, ما خلق العباد إلا ليعرفوه. He has not created his creatures except for one purpose. This purpose is not for his benefit. Hmm? This purpose is our purpose in life. Our purpose is ليعرفوه, so that they may come to know him, to understand him, to know of him. فَإِذَا عَرَفُوهُ عَبَدُوهُ. When they understand him, they will worship him. Which shows you that in Islam, ma'rifat, knowledge, comes before ibadat, worship. That worship is called a worship. That worship is valuable. That comes after knowledge, and that is preceded with knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay? فَإِذَا عَبَدُوهُ اسْتَغْنَوْا بِعِبَادَتِهِ عَنْ عِبَادَتِ مَا سِوَاهُ. And then when they worship him, then they have no need to worship anyone besides him. Now, coming back to the question of agnosticism. Can we know whether God exists or not? In Muslim academia, there are two sciences that rise up to the occasion in trying to answer this question. I don't call them Islamic sciences because they're not really Islamic sciences. They precede the whole discussion on Islam. They are fundamental philosophical discussions. But I call them sciences which are discussed in Muslim academia. Secondly, when I use the word science for them, don't think this is science in contrast to humanities. Here in this page, whenever I use the word science, I mean a body of knowledge, a field of study. So there are two fields of study that rise up to the occasion to answer this question. The first field of study is known as the field of mantiq. Mantiq meaning logic or ration or rationality. Okay? And mantiq is defined as that field of study that gives you the tools that you need to be able to think and draw up correct conclusions. Meaning that if you were to use these tools and practice these tools properly, you would protect yourself from drawing the wrong conclusions. Traditionally, in Islamic logic, or logic that was discussed in Muslim academia, they followed Aristotelian logic. And Aristotelian logic talked about different ways of proving or reasoning certain arguments. Talked about three primary ways of reasoning. The first one was deductive reasoning, which is called qiyas in Arabic. This is not the qiyas of fiqh, this is the qiyas of mantiq. Qiyas, deductive reasoning, also known as a syllogism. The other was inductive reasoning. In Arabic, that is? Anybody? It's istiqra, right? The third one was tamthil. And tamthil would be translated as the use of analogy. Okay. Now, even though Aristotle and Muslim scholars, you know, they talked about different ways of reasoning and argument, the most important way was the use of qiyas, of syllogisms. Okay. What's a qiyas? Can anybody give me an example of a qiyas? Without looking at your notes.
A is B, B is C.
Exactly. So the most, like, there are different forms of syllogisms. But the most basic form and the most important form of a syllogism is exactly what you told me right now. Look, if A is B and B is C, therefore it follows that A is also C, all right? And I just want to put up an example on the board. I just want us to talk about it a little bit. This will form the heart and soul of our discussions on the proofs for the existence of God, and how do we know that those proofs are true, and how do we know that the conclusions that we draw have actually a truth value to them or not. So one thing I didn't talk about as I was going leading up to this discussion is, inshallah, in the next few months, we want to talk about our three primary proofs for the existence of God. The first is the argument by design, or also known as the teleological argument. In Arabic or Farsi, it is known as Burhane Nazm. Good. The second one is the cosmological argument. Okay. So the first one, the teleological argument, the reason I'm bringing all of this up is because I'm leading towards something that will come up in the teleological argument. There was a philosopher and thinker in the 17th century by the name of David Hume. Hume wrote a very important criticism of the teleological argument. And at the heart of the criticism was his proposition that the teleological argument is based on empiricism.